forum to do business. Judiciary session is in committee. It's 11 minutes after 1:00. In attendance, Representative Lynn, Ramirez, Dahlstrom, Samuels. We have before us today, in this order, House Bill 158, 151, and 182. House Bill 158 needs to be adopted. And Representative Roses, if you'll come up and speak to it. Representative Dahlstrom, if you would offer the CS for House Bill 158.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the CS for House Bill 158, the E version, please.
We have the 25-LS0442/E before us. Representative Roses, pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate very much the committee bringing this bill up for consideration. I'm going to turn the majority of the presentation over to my staff member because I need to excuse myself and get into a resource committee that I think is also waiting for a quorum.
Okay.
So I want to just make a few brief comments before I go. In order to save time on this bill, and you'll probably hear some of what I'm telling you, you know, you may hear again, but one of the things that we've done, we have several people that are professionals that are involved in this particular aspect of what this bill covers. And rather than have three or four people continue to testify on the same thing, I think you're going to hear each one of them speak to only one portion or maybe two portions of the bill so that they're not repeating testimony. But I want to assure you that everything that one of them would have to say, they could all chime in and have their opinion on the entire aspect of the bill. But to try and keep it concise and in the essence of saving time for this committee, we're going to divide the responsibilities up on each of those aspects so that you don't have to hear it over and over again. So with that being said, I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill presented, and I'm going to turn it over to my staff member, Tim Martinson, and this is Tim's first opportunity as a new employee down here in the legislature, as I am, to be able to present a bill. But Tim has taken this bill from the very beginning to get it to this point, so he should be able to answer all of your questions. If he can't, I'm sure some of the expert testimony that you'll be hearing, they can. And if you still have questions after that, if you would get them back to me, I will absolutely make certain that your questions are answered as completely as they need to be for you to make the kind of decision you need to make in this committee. And with that, I would say thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Tim.
Okay, good to go. Tim, if you'll introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is Tim Martinson. I'm a legislative aide for Representative Bob Roses. Mr. Chairman, HB 158 enacts statewide licensing and regulation of private investigators and private investigator agencies. Currently, there is nothing in place to regulate private investigators and private investigator agencies. Absent standards and licensing enables anyone who holds themselves out as an investigator to offer investigative services without having to demonstrate even the most basic professional competence or experience. Primary among the many important reasons to support HB 158 is the protection of the consumer. There's no current requirement that they maintain professional liability and errors, omissions insurance. That leaves consumers with little or no recourse in the event of incompetence or misconduct on the part of unlicensed, unregulated investigators. Secondly, from a practical and financial standpoint, investigators in states without licensing standards and requirements are placed at serious disadvantages. Many insurance companies and law firms will not hire investigators unless they have been both licensed and insured. This means that out-of-state licensed investigators unfamiliar with Alaskan law and practices are hired and sent into Alaska conducting investigations that would normally generate income for Alaskan investigators. Licensing investigators with the strictures of House Bill 158 will provide only to those of good moral character who carry insurance and are able to meet educational and experience requirements. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to call upon Trace Lewis, my primary contact and expert in the field of private investigation, so that I can answer your questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for the bill sponsor first? Any questions? Okay, seeing none, please have them come up. Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Trace Lewis. I'm a private investigator with some 20 plus years of experience in the field of private investigations. And I have been working with Tim in regards to this bill. also online today are several other private investigators who are also my cohorts. We're all members of the Alaska Investigators Association, and we have been looking at licensing issues for several years amongst ourselves, and we were fortunate in that Representative Rosas agreed to introduce this bill. There are a number of problems that have occurred in the past. Some of those incidents are, I believe, in your book. It talks about some of the problems with people representing themselves to be private investigators. I could sit here and talk to you probably for an hour in regards to some of those issues, like the young man who was a high school student who graduated from high school, who went and bought a business license and hung himself out as a private investigator. Got in way over his head, finally had sense enough to call me, and we were able to straighten things out and keep the parties from being injured as a result of his just not knowing what the rules are. I can tell you that I was originally mentored by an attorney, and he mentored me for 3.5 years before I really felt, and most of my work at that during that period of time was done for him. And so I developed a pretty good education and understanding as to what I can and can't do, and of course that has changed a great deal in 20 years. The rules have changed. But this bill provides for people to have the opportunity to be mentored by going to work for other investigators. They can also get education and training by coming out and becoming investigators through law enforcement is another way they can do it. And they also can do a great deal of the background or the requirements for this bill by college education, specifically in this area. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If it's a question that I don't feel comfortable with, there's several people online that can assist.
Yes, sir. Representative Belson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Martinson, if I understand correctly, this bill is being brought before us because, not because of any particular problem, but just trying to organize the group and avoid potential problems in the future. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, that's correct. Yes.
Okay. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Lewis, for being here. How many members belong to the Alaska Investigators Association in Alaska?
Through the chair, roughly 50, Representative Dahlstrom.
Okay, and then, and I have to confess that I haven't read the whole entire packet, just with that's been on my plate for the last couple days. Can you talk a little bit about what the requirements are to be a member of the association and ongoing education that the members go through and who kind of guards the hen house there?
Well, the Alaska Investigators Association, through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, the Alaska Investigators Association is an organization of peers. And basically, annually, we have a conference. We have had conferences where we've had world-famous individuals come speak to us, such as Henry Lee, Frederick Whitehurst, who was a former FBI agent, who was the whistleblower on the FBI laboratory not conducting tests the way they should have been done. We've had investigators from the Anchorage Police Department come speak to us about doing homicide investigations. We've had polygraph examiners. We've had a number of people that come each year to our annual conference. Our conference last year, we had an individual who came to speak to us about computer forensics, which was a very enlightening seminar. So every year, the association offers continuing education available through its annual conference. The other thing is that several of the state agencies have investigators that work for them, and so they've also been coming to our conferences, and they allow us to go to some of the pieces and parts of their conferences, those of us who are not state employees. And as a result, we get a greater spectrum during these conferences of educational opportunities. So to answer the question, that's where the education has come from in the past. Now, many other professional organizations for investigators in other states offer educational opportunities, and many of them were just pay your money, come on down and take the educational opportunities. So there's plenty of opportunity out there to get your continuing education requirements. The second part of your question being as to what people have to do to become a member of the association. They fill out an application, they submit a background check, they pay their dues, and they attend their meet and pay their meetings. But that's as an association, we can't do much more without the backing of a state statute. Because there's nothing that requires people to belong to the association. And so those people who have wanted to be a part of the association have done so. And there are some people out there who have not. But and I think a fair number of people who are active in the field professionally are members of the association.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Grunberg has joined us, and so has Representative Coghill. More questions?
And just to follow up, sure. Do we have folks online from the...
We do. I was
referencing Department of Economic...
Yes, for the... Okay. For the benefit of the members of the committee, we have Ralph Taylor from Alaska Investigators, Kathy Monfrida from DPS, Andy Flams, and Flamser from Homer, representing himself, Joe Austin from Anchorage, representing himself, and Denise Marie Petty from Fairbanks with DCRI, Alaska Investigation Association. So we have some folks that want to call in. And the department that's going to do the licensing, is that the Department of Public Safety?
No, sir. The chair, it's our desire that the licensing be done through occupational licensing without a board.
Occupational licensing who?
Occupational licensing, state occupational licensing.
Yeah, I heard
without
that.
A board.
It's Department of Economic Commerce.
Without a board?
Without a board.
Without a board. So just the occupational licensing.
Correct.
Okay. If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, with one question.
Sure.
Pertaining to that particular request, have you discussed with the commissioner or Department of Public Safety?
Yes.
Those wishes, and are they going to speak to them if they're supportive or not?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, yes, we have spoken to them, and they are going to remain neutral on this. The reason why we got rid of the board was to decrease the fiscal note,
mm-hmm.
and we put it into occupational licensing, so if that helps.
So maybe a procedural question. Or it's not even a procedural, but administrative question. If it was under Department of Public Safety, would an existing board then be govern this, and we wouldn't have to create a new board?
Mr. Chairman, I think she was looking at me. I don't know that that's the case. I think this is a professional practices area that probably wouldn't fit under the police professional practices.
Okay.
So,
thank you. We're not creating a board.
No.
No. Just OC licensing. Are there provisions in here for revoking licenses? I see there's one here that the license expires for lack of the payment for the fee, but prohibited practices on that are listed here in section 700. How do you revoke the license, or how would OC licensing revoke the license?
Through the chair to Representative Samuels, it would be if somebody filed a complaint against an investigator. Occupational licensing has investigators who would go about conducting an investigation to see if the claim is valid. If the claim is valid, occupational licensing can suspend the license.
Okay. NOC licensing is going to testify, or they are not?
I do not see occupational licensing here. Mr. Rick Urien is here. Is that your gig these days, Mr. Urien? Is that your gig? Is that your thing these days? Nice. Yeah, so I'm sure that Mr. Urien would be available for us for questions. Any additional questions for the sponsor for Trace? Yes, sir.
To the chair, one thing that's so that the committee is aware, public safety has an inherent conflict of interest in regulating private investigators. I can give you a long list of troopers who respect me but don't like me. Because my job is to show where they have not successfully investigated or properly conducted the investigations in criminal cases. So inherently, to have somebody from public safety looking over my shoulder causes a tremendous conflict of interest. And this is one of the reasons why we have asked to have this be through occupational licensing and without a board.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cogdill.
I know that we'll probably get into it, but one of the questions I'll be asking along the way, and for your information, for Mr. Urien, because you're going to be talking about a standardized professional practices as lined out in the statute, what you're going to do is, rather than having peers peruse the qualification, the delinquency, the overstepping of a PI, you're going to turn that all over to staff control, and you may end up with a similar conflict of interest.
Okay.
So just be aware that I'll be asking, because what you're going to have is you're going to have application denials and suspensions all probably residing with an individual staff person without peer review. So I think I'm curious about that, and along the way we'll be asking about that.
Yes, sir.
Through the chair to Representative Cogdill, one of the things that the organization discussed was the fact that the state has private investigators working for occupational licensing, and they would have a pretty good understanding as to what an investigator does, how he goes about doing it, whether he's not doing it properly or not. And so that was one of the reasons why we looked at going without a board.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, you're welcome to stay there and supplement testimony. We're going to move to the testimony that we have offline. Is Mr. Taylor with us, Ralph Taylor?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hello, Mr. Taylor. If you could leave your remarks as brief as possible. We're trying to get through a considerable workload today. But if you'll introduce yourself and give us your remarks, we appreciate it.
My name is Ralph Taylor, and I'm the Secretary of the Alaska Investigators Association. And I'd like to comment briefly on education requirements. And this is what I would like to say, Mr. Chair, is that education is imperative in any profession. Whether that profession is seeking to improve itself or maintain a professional image, standards and training and education go hand in hand with high ethical standards. You can't separate those issues. Where you have no education requirements, you have no ethical requirements or standards. It's with this in mind that I request respectfully, sir, that the committee support this bill and provide some educational standards for the investigators in the state of Alaska and licensing requirements. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Taylor? We appreciate you speaking on behalf of the bill. Ms. Montfredo, are you with
Thank
us?
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir, I am.
Would you like to make a statement, or are you available for questions?
Just for the record, my name is Catherine Monfreda. I'm the Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau with the Alaska Department of Public Safety, and I'm really just here to answer any questions relating to the background check portion of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Ma'am, we have a memo from Joan Kasson, K-A-S-S-O-N, dealing with a potential amendment. Are you familiar with that email?
Through the chair, yes, I am.
Okay, we prepared an amendment that would insert a new bill section amending AS 12.62.400 to add a new paragraph 15 to read, quote, licensure as a private investigator or private investigator agency under AS 08.85, close quote. Do you support that amendment?
Yes, sir, I do. I recommended that that will ensure that national background checks, fingerprint-based background checks, could be conducted.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Are there any other questions? Yes, Representative Cargill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll wait. Thank you.
Kathy, The bill sponsor says that you're neutral on this. Can you just weigh in for us, what are the pros and the cons of licensing and regulating private investigators?
Thank you.
Through the chair, I can't really speak to that. As far as the Records and Identification Bureau goes, it would be very little impact. 50 or so applicants a year is not going to impact us. There was some question regarding the Department of Public Safety being required to review the applications, and I haven't gotten any information on whether or not I am supposed to address that or not.
There's no board now.
Okay.
Can you tell us, we have a fiscal note here that talks about a state trooper sitting on the board. Is this an outdated fiscal note?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes it is. It's not in there anymore.
Okay. Are there any questions for Kathy?
No.
Kathy, would you stand by for us, though, as we cover this in case we have questions at the Department of Public Safety?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Thank you. We appreciate it a lot. Next, if we can go to Andy Klamser in Homer. Andy, are you with us?
I am. Thank you.
Since you're representing yourself, are you affiliated in any way with?
I am on the board of directors of the Alaska Investigators Association, and I'm a past president. I spent 20 years in law enforcement and the last 10 years in the private sector. Most of my work is for law firms and insurance companies. I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, there's considerably more people operating in the state as private investigators than belong to the state association. Potentially there's more than 50. One issue I want to speak to briefly is just reciprocity. The other 42 states that regulate private investigators, many of them have provisions in their laws for reciprocity with other states that also license investigators. So if I go outside to another state, there's a means by which I can legally operate for a limited period of time. We can't do that, obviously, if we don't have licensing. The other area I want to cover just briefly is Alaska has, in the last 10 years, enacted a fair amount of new laws dealing with victim protection and witness protection, particularly in the areas of child sexual abuse and sexual assault. And the federal government has enacted laws dealing with identity theft and consumer privacy protection. I think it's important that anybody that is operating in this field in Alaska, particularly doing criminal defense investigations, has a good working knowledge of those laws and abides by them. Those really are my only comments. I support HB 155, and I urge that you pass it.
Thank you. If I could ask you a quick question, or you, Trace, what's the present manner in which you remove somebody who's a private investigator versus it's pretty well spelled out that there will be an investigation by occupational licensing once they are licensed and regulated. What if you got a rogue guy now?
To answer your question, we have no recourse. That individual could go out and go to work and get somebody to hire him anywhere he wants. The only thing that has been controlling people like that is the marketplace. But in the meantime, a man can go out and say, yeah, I'll do this for you. Give me a $5,000 retainer. And he may not be skilled. He may have no knowledge and walk away with the consumer's $5,000 and produce nothing. And what is the recourse other than maybe a fraud investigation through the district attorney's office, which may or may not go anywhere?
Questions for Mr. Klamser? Mr. Klamser, thank you very much for taking time out of your day. How about Mr. Joe Austin from Anchorage? Would you state your name, your record, and your affiliation?
Yes, my name is Joe Austin. I'm a private investigator here in Anchorage. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Investigators Association and currently serve on the board of directors. I am here to voice my opinion in support of House Bill 158. I won't go into a lot more of the details that my the other folks have outlined. I do want to point out some specific issues. I recently did some research on the number of private investigator licenses, which are just a business license. Currently, there are 165 total in the state of Alaska. 40 of those are from out-of-state firms. I also checked the Yellow Pages here in Anchorage for 2006 and 2007. Under private detectives and private investigators, there are 40 advertisements in the Yellow Pages. And of all those 40, there are only currently licensed 11. And I did a random check on several of the persons currently holding licenses, and licenses expired. Here are some of the criminal backgrounds that I found in checking on some of these individuals with that under House Bill 158 would not be able to obtain a license. Sexual assault and registered sex offender out of compliance, hindering prosecution, domestic violence assault, theft, commercial bribery. Those were names that I found that hold current PI business licenses. I also found some that were expired license that had sex crimes and failed to register as a sex offender. So I am here asking for your support in passing this House Bill 158. I have covered in my letter I sent down in support of this bill, I have gone into a little bit more detail on specific cases if you're interested in reading them. And I will be happy to answer any questions anybody may have.
Any questions, Mr. Austin? Let me also represent Representative Holmes has joined us. Representative Coghill?
Is there any other licensing within the state? I notice in the bill it talks about other political subdivisions and their licensing. Does Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau provide licensing? Maybe the person online testifying could tell me. Otherwise, I'll defer to the sponsor.
Yeah, I can answer that question for you through the chair to Representative Coghill. In the municipality of Anchorage, you are required to obtain a business license for the municipality, and you have to provide to the clerk's office a copy of your criminal history check and pay your money. There's no requirements for education, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carter.
Also, for the guy testifying or for the sponsor, with the investigation authority that you have now and with the openness that you have, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, by the way, but are there new authorities that you're going to acquire under this that, albeit protected as they are still new authorities?
I'll be happy to answer that through the chair to Representative Coghill. The answer is no. The things that are in the bill basically are things that we do today. We're not getting any new rights or privileges or abilities at all, with the exception of one area, and that is on a national basis. There are some database companies that provide information to investigators, which we would use in an attempt to locate witnesses or assets or other things that were involved in litigation. Some of those companies will not do business with unlicensed private investigators. If you're asking if we have any new authorities by virtue of the statute that would be of a legal nature, I don't believe so. I believe we'd get some privileges with some private companies that we don't have now.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Thomas? Mr. Austin? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony today. How about Denise Marie Petty out of Fairbanks?
Hello.
Hi, Denise. If you'd introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Denise Marie Petty. I own and operate DC Recovery and Investigations in Fairbanks, Alaska. I am the current Alaska Investigators Association president, and I would like to, what I'm going to do instead of bringing yet another topic up is summarize what my peers and colleagues have brought to light. HB 158 we support wholeheartedly because it sets standards and it institutes accountability for people that are performing services to insurance companies, attorneys, private individuals that can either, that have the capability to do great good or cause great harm. And those areas being continuing education, background checks, being able to have reciprocity so we're able to carry our investigations into other jurisdictions where needed, as well as other investigators that are offering us those privileges to be allowed to do so in Alaska within the limited scope of HB 158. The ultimate goal is to protect the consumer through this accountability. It may not prevent individuals necessarily from committing these crimes, as Mr. Austin had pointed out, but it will give the consumer, first of all, the ability to check and verify the credentials of the individual holding themselves out as an investigator, as well as through bonding and insurance, a way to recover via damages.
Is that it?
I was just basically recapping. I have great concerns with with us losing our access to information, our ability to serve our clients. I'm very concerned about individuals who are not of good moral character, honest, or who are sex offenders or criminals holding themselves out to be investigators and the potential damage they could cause. And so those reasons are why AIA, as well as myself, are supporting HB 158.
Thank you, Representative Coghill.
Thank you, and I appreciate you testifying. Do you fall under other laws that might be attention on your work, for example, stalking laws and things like that? Do you folks have issues there?
Through the chair to Representative Coghill, I'm sorry, but I don't understand the question specifically.
Well, since part of your responsibility is keeping tabs on a person's whereabouts, I just wondering if other laws were in tension. For example, if somebody felt that you were stalking them, could they have a right on you now that they may not have under this bill? That's kind of what I was looking for.
I don't believe that there will be any additional rights. To my understanding of the law, if stalking and harassment are when you are acting in such a way during the course of the investigation for that person to, first of all, notice that they're being investigated and, second, to feel threatened, it is my opinion that a good investigator is going to be able to do it in such a manner that they're not going to violate that person's rights and that they are not going to know that they are being investigated. Does that answer your question, sir?
Good, and it looks like we have some other answer here, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair to Representative Coghill, most of the time when we are asked to do surveillance, we are given the instructions of please do not let the party become aware that you are conducting the investigation. And that is pretty much uniform and I can't recall a case that I've ever conducted surveillance where I was told to do anything but remain anonymous, to the point where if I had to stop because I was fearful that I was going to be identified as conducting an investigation, that I was to do that, even if it meant that I was done, might not be able to do anything more. I was told not to do that. So I don't believe that we will garner any rights. I mean, we could be arrested for harassment or stalking if we get carried away. I believe so.
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. I guess kind of what I was looking for is, number one, protection for you, but also protection for people. Do you think that this might embolden private investigators because of the specific language set forth here?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, no, because the insurance companies who hire us don't want us to contact these people.
Okay. I'm just asking for your protection, right, and for others.
Right.
Just want to know what the parameters are. Thank you.
For the bill sponsor, bonding was removed from a previous version of the bill. Previous version required a surety bond of $15,000 or more. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, the reason why we did away with that is because there was an additional requirement requiring them to purchase errors and omissions insurance for $100,000. The errors and omissions insurance is better because With the bond, you have to go through the state, you have to go through the court. With the insurance, you make a claim and you can get your, potentially get your money back.
Additional questions? Seeing none, we have Representative Dawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lewis, you stated your biggest client group comes from insurance companies.
Through the chair, that is one. I also work for a number of individual attorneys. I've done major criminal felonies throughout the state. Without sounding like I'm bragging, you may have actually seen me on television on some of these major felonies that I have worked in the recent past. So it's not just insurance companies, but they are certainly a large segment of the industry.
And do you workers' comp and divorce type issues or fidelity issues where a spouse might contact you?
Well, again, through the chair to Representative Dahlstrom, I have not done any domestic or cases in probably 15 years when Alaska became a no-fault divorce state. Mm-hmm. It's not really appropriate for an investigator to do that work when he simply could advise the individual that this is a no-fault divorce state. Me going out and finding out whether or not your spouse is cheating or not is not going to do you any good in the courtroom. And so I have always shied away from that kind of work. In relationship to workers' comp, yes, ma'am, I do workers' comp, but that's usually through the insurance company. Mm-hmm. Other work for, I did some work here recently where I was found a number of prior property owners to get them to sign off on some documents so that a lawsuit had to be filed to clear title to a piece of land. So I've also found adoptees, the parents of children that were placed up for adoption. One of those cases was for medical reasons. I've done work finding heirs to an estate that was exceeded $100 million. So there's a lot of other things that go on in this industry that are not related to insurance companies or surveillance or criminal or even civil cases.
Thank you.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably less to the bill and more to the industry itself. There are things that you can do that law enforcement cannot do. Is that evidence, not breaking and entering, but
Again, through the chair, to Representative Samuels, no. If there are times that we have access to our clients and people and sometimes to witnesses who don't want to cooperate with law enforcement, but we have no special rights. We have no special rights to those particular people. We may have access to database companies that have decided that they don't want to do business with law enforcement. But again, that's not a right that's bestowed to us by in any fashion other by law or regulation.
Okay, so there's nothing that you can do that a police officer cannot do. Wiretaps, looking through the trash for a piece of evidence. Plain sight type.
Well, okay, go through the chair. Yes, I can go do what's called a trash run, where I can grab your trash off the corner and see what your bills are, or if you happen to throw them in the trash. No, sir, I cannot get a wiretap, and no, sir, I cannot get a court to approve a wiretap.
Okay, and then the information that you do find out, is there a confidentiality in law, or if you have a contract with your client, this is to keep this cuff confidential?
Well, again, through the chair to Representative Samuels, yes, we're confidentiality is assumed with the word private investigator, because basically information we obtain, frequently it's obtained through the attorney-client privilege. And so the only person that is entitled to have that information is the client and the attorney, information that we gather when we're doing it in that particular situation. So I would be out of business if I broke confidentiality rules, and we probably actually within the industry are more careful about that than many other people are. In terms of being subject to a subpoena and having to divulge those things, well, then that becomes legal battles between the attorneys and the courts. But for the most part, our work is all confidential.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you were to make an arrest, it would be a citizen's arrest, the same as if I was to make a citizen's arrest. And then I'm curious how many times that happens.
Through the chair to Representative Dahlstrom, I have no arrest authority whatsoever other than that of a citizen. I have never arrested anybody as a result of having observed or seen a criminal act. The exception to that rule is on two occasions I have actually returned to prison individuals who were out on bail, mm-hmm. who had violated the conditions of the release, had returned themselves and had told their attorneys about that, and their attorneys asked me to take them back to the jail so that we could then handle it in that fashion.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page, by the way, I like the CS, and you both talked to me, and I appreciate your putting this stuff in that we talked about and dealing with that. But one thing I hadn't really focused on, if the members would look at page 9, top of page 9, dealing with confidentiality of personal identification information. And you list the residential address as being confidential, residential telephone number, electronic mail address, social security number, photograph, quote, and other personal identifying information that is disclosed under AS 0885-150, unquote. And if the members would turn back to 0885-150, there are some 18 things that are listed there, some of which might, in the eyes of some people, be considered personal identifying information and possibly not in the eyes of other people. If you want things to be confidential, and you've listed some things here, I think you should list the other things, too, that you want to have confidential. And, Mr. Chair, I would ask, are you prepared to do that now, or do you want to take a little bit of time to study this to see what else you want to have rather than just putting it into a catch-all phrase, since you've been very careful to list the 18 things on here?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'd like to take some time to look through this.
Does the bill go? It goes to finance. Well, I don't want to hold the bill up here, but I would ask that you do that before this bill gets to the floor so that we have a complete list. I don't want to have people concerned that things were or were not on the list when it could have been easily cured here.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Are there questions? I want to bring Mr. Urien up so that we can ask him some questions vis-a-vis occupational safety and licensing. Are there other questions for these gentlemen? Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, and I would just ask you, Tim, if you'd let Deneen on my staff know what you're doing on that, if you can follow that through.
Rick, would you come up for some punishment, please?
You've been reading too many Mike Hammer mysteries.
Mr. Urien, it's always such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And the administration takes a neutral stance on the bill before you. As you know, we license people for public protection and public safety. And we don't think unlicensed activity by investigators rises to the level of needing a legislation or licensure at this time. Although you've heard a number of problems here today, and if you and your wisdom decide that you want to license these people, we stand by ready to do just as you direct us to do. There was some concern voiced earlier about whether we can license people without a board or without there's some sort of a conflict of interest. We license a lot of people without boards, and we can do it very well. We have 21 different boards that we serve, and we license about 18 other categories of professionals without boards. The largest of those is contractors, and we have a staff that's quite capable. If you set the criteria in law, we will follow that and make licensure easy. For Representative Grunberg, he pointed out in the There are some confidentiality things in this bill. Those provisions are what we keep confidential, not what they keep confidential. There are directions for us, if we are the license agency, to keep confidential their names and addresses, telephone numbers, addresses, and Social Security numbers. And I'm certainly here prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Uren. Could you give us just a three or four on each side of that ledger, those that are licensed and those that aren't? Hairdressers are, architects are. What's some other categories that are licensed with or without a board? That was the question I meant to ask. I'm sorry.
Contractors aren't. I should know the whole list, but
three or four.
There's a lot. We plumbers and electrical administrators, plumbers, morticians. There's a lot.
Maybe I could help. It looks like there's a professional society that you would go to for some issues on this. Just like with your plumbers, you probably have not only national codes, but you also have state and national organizations. What would you do in a case where you have, for example, this professional private investigators group that might be challenged by somebody who wants to enter the field, but they feel is unfit, and yet you could find unfit? Do you, that's what I was looking for, the kind of the pure understanding of the value. I understand the statutory part, but there are some times where you get kind of put in those judgment call situations.
Yes, to the chair, there are times, frankly, I wish our licensing laws had a little bit more leeway, because I get put in that position quite frequently. Uh-huh. About making a judgment call as to whether someone qualifies to be something. And believe you me, it usually comes down to the point where somebody's been a plumber for 35 years, and he didn't take the test 2 years ago or some such thing, and quite frankly, we give them a license. You know, we make a lot of those judgment calls, and so there is a fine line between the protection of the public and protection of the profession. And a lot of our people step over that line, in my opinion, and it's very fine that sometimes they make it restrictive so the next person can't come in. Our boards keep raising the bar. I've got my license, we raise the bar. Now it takes, instead of 4 years of college, it takes a master's degree or something, you know.
That was the next question I wanted to ask, and Trace, ask it to you. Do you have a four-year college degree? I mean, are we going to exclude certain people that have been practicing, you know, that have a lifetime of experience that aren't going to, that somebody, let's say that you do not, you've got 20 years in the industry, are you not going to be a Class A investigator because you don't meet the qualifications of this? What do we have some practicing investigators that are now, you know, have a domestic violence or a conviction in their past that now are going to be excluded from being private investigators?
Through the chair, to answer the question, there is a provision in the end of the bill which basically anybody who's currently conducting would be kind of grandfathered into the end of this to take care of those particular situations that may exist out there by people who are well qualified, who have been in the occupation and have not in some fashion done something in the recent past that would cause a problem with the public trust. Look at the licensing situations in terms of whether or not somebody's qualified or not in terms of college educations and things like that. This bill is set out with various standards. If you have a four-year degree, you're only required to have 1,500 hours of experience. If you have no college degree, then you need 4,500 hours of experience. So people coming into this occupation can come in through a college education, go to work for somebody who has a Class A agency license, generate enough time to eventually get their own Class A license. They can also come into this occupation through law enforcement, where they have exceeded the number of training hours requirements to come into it. So there'll be multiple avenues of people entering the occupation.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, to be a little devil's advocate here, if you claim that there's a problem out there, and yet you exempt all those people in the business today and you let them in, you haven't solved the problem. I would get a little antsy as the regulator that I'm supposed to tell that all these PIs are good people when my hands are tied.
Mr. Urien, you just read me in the vice chair's mind, I think. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, both of you. And one of the things, if I heard you correctly, Mr. Lewis, was that when talking about grandfathering in members, that would look at issues that may or may not have happened in the past, and I think you said something about amount of time or something that had passed so that there was public trust. And I guess the first thing that's coming to mind right now is something I heard in the very first couple of minutes of the testimony, and that is, you know, people that are convicted sex offenders or whatever that, I mean, in my mind, I don't care how much time has gone by.
Right.
They shouldn't be licensed.
But under the transpositional provisions in the bill, it meets the qualifications of AS 85110, and then provides, which is basically the all of the basic requirements for licensing, and then provides evidence satisfactory to the department that the person has performed 1,500 hours or more of private investigative work in the industry. So they still have to qualify for those particular items.
So
as I'm saying, there is a transitional method for people who are in the industry today.
Representative Dahlstrom, then Lynn.
Thank you.
I don't have anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they're in the industry, they may be doing extremely well in the industry. They have their 1,500 hours. They have the sex crime record on.
They won't qualify.
But they're already working.
Well, they might not qualify because under this particular section, their requirement is.
I can.
Yeah, if you're the bill sponsor, if you'd pull up. Mr. Urien, thank you very much. It's always nice to see you.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, the transitional provisions.
Where are they located, please?
It's in the very, very last page.
Page 13.
So the transitional provisions, they don't allow everyone that's out there to just come in. You still have to meet the qualifications of the bill.
Okay. And so help me out here. Tell me in this bill where it says that someone who's a convicted, I'm going to go back to my example, sexual offender,
okay,
is not qualified no matter how many hours they have.
Okay, page 2, line 16, may not have been convicted of a felony in any jurisdiction in 10 years preceding the license application.
And why 10 years? What's the arbitrary? I mean, a felony is a felony. What's with 10 years? You're a guy after 10 years?
Through the chair, process servers in the state can become process servers if they've had no felony convictions in the last 10 years. Let me tell you that a process server can walk into a bank and execute and take $10 million out of a checking account.
So
that's standard.
So what?
So they can take money, they can take assets, they can serve process. They're quasi-court officers.
Representative Dahlstrom?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, then a processor falls under this bill then?
No, does not. They're separately licensed by the Department of Homeland
Security. Okay, so you were using that as an example of another area that need to be strengthened.
No, I'm using that as another area to show that that's where this came from, particular standard came from.
Okay, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I mean, totally, you got to know where I'm coming from on this. I don't care if it's 10 years or 20 years or whatever. There's certain things that certain crimes that I just think that we have to just pay the consequences of our actions. And I mean, we just got done as, you know, a House bipartisan working on this ethics bill to hold ourselves to. I mean, we live in a fishbowl, and hold ourselves to high standards and penalties for things that taking away pensions and, you know, all those things. you know.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if you look down at line 18 on page 2, it says may not have been convicted of a crime of dishonesty or sexual misconduct.
Okay, but when I asked previously, what I was referred to was the line above it that talked about the 10 years.
Yep.
I don't.
That's through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom. That's regarding a felony conviction.
Maybe.
So there could be a sexual crime that's not a felony.
No.
Representative Samuels and Grunberg.
Thank you. Number 2 is any felony, and then mm-hmm. it fine tunes it more on number 3. So the sex crimes, you're out.
Representative
a different felony you can possibly be in if you wait 10 years.
My intention is to introduce an amendment on line 16 and 17 of page 2 to say may not have been convicted of a felony, period.
Okay.
Is my intention.
Okay.
Okay, we've heard from anybody. Any more questions, Representative Grunberg?
Just to answer Representative Dahlstrom, the specific would control over the general. So with respect to a sex crime, there's no time limit, because that's what it is. I'm sorry. I don't think I have a question. Sorry, I had a question.
Are there other questions for the bill sponsor?
Oh, yes, I do. I
lost my pencil. You got me.
Through the chair. I'd like the members to look at page 10, lines 13 through 15.
What page?
10. Okay. The immunity. And I'm asking this to Mr. Lewis and the members of the profession. I have been involved with cases where there have been investigations done in family law cases, and they deal with child custody,
right. Generally,
not property. Although, you know, very frankly, having a private investigator investigate financial and due tracing in property is extremely important quite often. So it's not just a question of whether you're incompatible, it's a question on these very list of legitimate issues you need help to do your investigation. And particularly in highly emotional child custody matters, sometimes the losing party looks at filing complaints against the other attorney and the private investigator. And I just ask, if I may have a little latitude through the chair, any of the PIs who are in the audience or on the line, this just immunizes a person who files a complaint in good faith. It doesn't require that there be some kind of a reasonable basis, because you could really have a litigant who has emotional problems and is completely acting in good faith but with emotional problems without any basis in fact.
Mr.
To file a complaint.
Representative Grunberg, if you're going to take the latitude in this committee, which you're welcome to do, it would be helpful if you didn't show up 20 minutes late for the committee proceedings. Is this leading to a succinct question?
Yes, it is. I was working on a floor amendment for today, and that's why I was. Has any member of the profession seen a situation where there should also be a reasonable basis, in fact, for that kind of immunization?
And who is this question for?
It's for anybody online, anybody in the profession. Because I'm concerned about somebody who may be acting subjectively in good faith, but have an emotional problem, and would be immunized here, even though there's no basis at all, and they're doing it, and it really has a harassing effect on the personal, the private investigator. I'm wondering if there's anybody who cares to comment on that online, Mr. Chair. Or Mr. Lewis.
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, I've never seen a situation like that. It doesn't mean that something's not happened, I'm not aware of, but in my 20-plus years, I've never had a problem, and I've never been aware of anybody ever having a problem.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, with that, are there any more questions for the bill sponsor? Excellent. Is there anybody here in the room that wants to testify condition on this? Is there anybody online? Anybody else online? All right, seeing none, public testimony is closed. We have before us House Bill 158. Representative Grunberg, do you want to introduce amendment number one?
I introduce the amendment that would go to page 13, following line 16, as amendment number one.
Is there an objection? Without objection, amendment number one is passed. Susan, I will introduce conceptual amendment number two on page 2, lines 16 and 17, to delete in any jurisdiction in the 10 years preceding license application. So it would read number two would read may not have been convicted of a felony. Period. Amendment number Representative Holmes objects for the purpose of discussion. Is there a discussion? Representative Holmes?
A hopefully friendly suggestion. We might want to consider leaving the words in any jurisdiction in. Simply, it would clarify that it would include felonies outside of Alaska.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The conceptual amendment is amended to read in any jurisdiction. Representative Grunberg?
Yes, I would like to know from Mr. Lewis or the sponsor if there's any objection to going back open-ended in that.
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, I suspect that I know of at least two investigators who have 20-plus years of experience that amendment will put out of business. And when I say that they have 20 years of experience, I mean I know that from having been associated with them. I also know that that, as I said before, process servers, currently the requirement is 10 years. The process servers can, frankly, be more subject to that than...
So, Mr. Lewis, if we changed it to 20 years, then I would assume that they didn't commit a felony while they were being investigators. So a 20-year prohibition would satisfy them to be able to retain their employment?
That's correct.
Okay. I would amend the conceptual amendment number two to say in the 20 years preceding license application, so the line 16 and 17 would remain the same, and on line 17, 10 would be changed to 20. That would satisfy?
I believe so.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll only object for the purposes of discussion, because I just wonder what the statute of limitations is on felonies generally. I think on some of the alcohol-related ones, we go back 15 years, I think, don't we? And I don't know what the others are. I know on sex offenders there is no statute of limitation on that. Is there any others that we need to be aware of?
Representative Grunberg?
Yes, and I don't know if we have anybody from law. I don't know if Mr. Urien can correct me if I'm wrong. It's normally 5 years. For sexual offenders, it's longer because of the age of majority and things like this. There's special statutes. Murder has no statute of limitations. But that, what we're talking about there is a limitation for the prosecution of the crime. These are people who've already been convicted.
And that's, Mr. Chairman, that's one of the reasons why I know that under the drunk driving one, we put a prohibition of 10 years, I think, for that it had to be on their record for 10 years. And that's kind of what we're doing here. We're saying 20 years, that felony is a valid bar to their licensure for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
I just wanted to ask out loud to make sure that it's fairly consistent with what we've done in other statutes, I think. So I'll remove my objection.
So we have before us a conceptual amendment number two, changing 10 to 20.
No objection.
The objection maintained. Rejection.
Objection.
The objection is removed. Amendment number two passes. Are there any other amendments to House Bill 158? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion to move 158 from plea. Representative Dahlstrom?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make the motion to move the CS for House Bill 158, version E, with attached zero physical notes and individual recommendations.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
And amendments.
I should put on the record that the law firm for which Mr. Lewis works, and possibly Mr. Lewis himself, I'm not sure, have done work for me and my family, just to put that on the record.
So noted. Seeing no objection, House Bill 158 moves from committee. Thank the bill sponsor. Did an excellent job. Well done. Mr. Lewis, thank you for your help. You did a great job of managing that bill. Next up is House Bill 151. Representative Sims?
We're next.
Oh, sorry. It's 182 is ordered in the book, but I have our list is.
You want 151?
Yes. I see Representative Johnson is here. Representative Lynn is also here.
Here, I've got 150.
Representative Johnson, and we will, Representative Lynn, I received some mail on House Bill 182, and I think we will reserve the last 15 minutes for this. Do we have much testimony on?
I believe we have Mr. Sniffen will be online. Okay. Only my staff here told me we only have one person. That'd be Mr. Ed Sniffen online, and I would assume hope this would go pretty fast.
Okay, we will reserve 2:45 to take up House Bill 182 as a courtesy to our member. With that, Representative Johnson, the floor is yours until 2:45.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope if I was quiet long enough, the same would happen to this bill as happened last time, that I didn't need to say anything, it would just pass, but I guess that's not going to be the case this time. Thank you. For the record, my name is Craig Johnson, Representative District 28. Before you today is HB 151, and basically what 151 does is requires uniform indemnification and hold harmless provisions in professional service contracts for all public agencies within the state. It ensures a sound public policy and is fair business practices between the public and the private sector. It assures accountability for all parties involved in professional service contracts, and it prevents one party from being absolved from their own responsibility for their own negligence. And bottom line is it saves the state money. Currently, some of the contracts that are signed by the state for professional services, specifically construction, engineering, contracting type. The engineer, the designer, is responsible for and must hold harmless all the way through the process, even though it may be someone else's fault or someone else is to blame for, to no fault of his own, he must defend that person. The problem with that is you go through court, you win the case, and there you are with all your court costs. You may have nothing to do with the problem, but because the contract stated that you would indemnify basically everyone along the line, that you're on the hook for it.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
You are going to run into a brick wall with me on House Bill 151 because my Uncle Bill Sladen is just built Zion Lutheran, the daycare center, and I am right in the midst of a contractor and an architect, and man, is there some finger pointing going on that, and I'm looking at the letters of support, and they're all from architects and engineers.
Well,
so if you can explain that to me, this is by request.
It's actually by the design council. And it's something that I firmly believe in, and I would be more than happy to take by request off.
I bet they do.
This is primarily Representative Ramirez for state contracts. This is not anything to do with two private individuals who want to sign a contract and indemnify each other. That is not the purpose of this bill. The purpose of this bill is to basically take the Department of Transportation's language that they've been using for years and apply it across the board to state contracts. What's happening is in certain state contracts with certain agencies, you're forced to indemnify all the way through, which means the architect or the engineer is responsible for defending, even though maybe someone way down the road constructed improperly or improperly maintained it, that they're on the hook for defending that all the way through. So in terms of private-to-private contractors, this will not affect those contracts. What this basically does is adopt the Department of Transportation language that's been used for years and runs it throughout the system. Basically, it means that if you're responsible for an error, you're responsible for the error, and you alone, and you don't have to have, someone else is not going to have to defend you if you made the mistake. So I think you're really talking apples and oranges here, and I hope that brick wall is somewhat diminished.
I like contractors.
Well, there's, Mr. Chairman, there is nothing wrong with contractors. I like everyone that in the construction trades. What I don't like is for people who make mistakes not being held accountable for those mistakes. And that's what we're talking about here. If it's an engineer who makes a mistake, the engineer's on the hook. If it's the designer who makes the mistake, the designer's on the hook. If it's a contractor who makes the mistake, the contractor's on the hook. This doesn't do anything to diminish anyone's responsibility. As a matter of fact, it probably amplifies that and makes it more likely that the person who is actually responsible is going to be held accountable.
But Representative Johnson, they always go like this. I mean, that's the nature of what they do. It's always like this. I don't know a builder in the world that hasn't blamed the architect or the engineer for the design defect on the building. And I don't see the ABC or AGC or any contractor that is on our list of folks testifying here. Are they aware of this bill moving through? Representative Sanders, you had a question.
Mr. Chairman, this bill has been noticed. It's been heard in State Affairs. It was filed very early in the session. I've had several conversations with other people on various matters in all of those fields, construction, and no one has called my attention to a problem with this bill. We do have online the insurance agents all the way through the line. Part of the problem with the system works now is you can't even buy insurance for this. You cannot buy insurance that will allow you to indemnify someone else. So every time one of these people, an engineer, contractor, whomever it is, they're on the hook for it, and they put their company at stake every time they bid one of these jobs. This language has been used, like I say, by the Department of Transportation for years, and we have people online, I think, that will testify to that effect. And once again, I want to clarify that you're always going to have problems, and people are always going to be pointing at each other. And if you have two people in a conflict, that's what the courts are for. But when you have three people in a conflict, and you have one person who may not be responsible at all having to foot the bill for the person who is responsible, I think you're talking totally different set of circumstances here than what you're talking about. If these two people that you're talking about are pointing at each other, they sue each other, a court will make that decision, and then they're on the hook for it. But what this bill does is, through no fault of their own, someone screws up somehow that the third person down here who had nothing to do with it must defend everyone. So we're not trying to circumvent the courts. We will never stop finger pointing. That will continue to happen. What this does is let the fingers be pointed at the appropriate person and the person responsible for their actions. It's held accountable. The fact of the matter is that it costs the state a lot of money every year because people either, the best people don't bid because they have to indemnify these certain projects. They bid their project up considerably to cover the potential cost. And worst of all is they just don't bid. And so we lose the services of some of the best engineers, designers, in the state. So I really think that the discussion is not exactly what you see as a problem. The discussion that I would like to have, and you probably won't allow me to have, but would like to, is the people being held accountable for their own errors. And if they don't make them, they shouldn't be held accountable for other people's errors. And that's basically what this bill does. It's language that's tried and true through Department of Transportation for many, many years.
Are there questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the definition here of consultant on page 2, line 24. It says it's a person who contracts with a public agency to provide professional services. I'm reading through this here, trying to figure out where sub-consultants come in, because often when you have somebody who contracts with the state to build, they aren't going to do the whole thing by themselves. They're going to have a bunch of subs. So if I'm the state of Alaska and I've signed on to something like this with a consultant to do a construction project, and they've got 18 subs and something goes wrong, who do I go to?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I think that basically contract law says the contractor is responsible, the subs are responsible to that contractor, and ultimately, mm-hmm. if you subcontract stuff, you are still on the hook for that contract. That's a different story. That would be between the two parties. And if they have an indemnification clause within theirs, then that's a private-to-private contract. What we're talking is a little different. We're talking about state agencies that contract with private companies and mandate that there is an indemnification clause within that contract, so that regardless, whatever happens way down the line, even though it may be the state that does something in error, if it's the engineer or the designer, they're going to be held responsible. This basically places accountability where it belongs.
So you would see this as, you would see the reading of the word consultant in this document to include all sub-consultants who are contractually linked to the consultant. Is that what your intent is, to hold the consultant liable for their own errors as well as the errors of their own subs, and then they can go after their subs if they need to. That's their issue. But as far as the state is concerned, if the contractor or any of their subs it's their negligence that caused the problem, the state goes straight through the contractor that they have the contractual relationship with, and the contractor deals with their subs.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that is my understanding of it, and I think that's the way contract law is pretty much interpreted, at least when I went to college.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things I'd like to get clarification on, if you know now or at a later point, is my understanding is that depending on the type and the size of the construction job, sometimes it's up to the subs to get their own bonding, not the major contractor that received the initial contract. And so I see that could potentially.
Through the chair, Representative Dawson, I would assume that that's always the case, that you wouldn't want to contract with someone that didn't have bonding, wasn't licensed, certified in bonding in any circumstances. I'm not sure we're not drilling down in a little deeper with this than is really necessary. What we're talking about is a contract between the state, a design engineer, or construction a company or whomever, that you still will be held responsible. You did the bid. You're the one that's on the hook. If one of your subs makes a mistake, if that contractor didn't require the bonding, the contractor is still going to be there, but it will fall back on their bond. So I would think any prudent contractor would make sure that the subs they had were properly bonded, and it may be a requirement of some of the contracts of the state. But I think we're drilling down a little deeper with this than I don't know that we need to, because it's certainly the purview of the committee. But let's take it up to the next level, where you're talking the designer contracts with the state. And I want to be clear that we're only talking about state agencies here. We really don't want to go out and talk about what two people do in their private contract of indemnification is strictly up to them. That's not what we're trying to affect here. What we're trying to affect here is saving the state money and allowing some of the best people we have working on it to not have to suffer through the crushing burden of indemnifying all the way down the line to the finished product and even beyond, that maybe they had nothing to do with it, but as the chairman says, a lot of finger pointing. If a building is completely built and someone slips on the ice and someone just said, boy, if that would have been designed differently, I wouldn't have fallen, even though the owner of the building didn't clean the ice, although it wasn't properly done, the person who has to defend all the way through the process is that engineer who signed that hold harmless clause. That's unfair, it's not right, and it doesn't put accountability where it belongs, and that's with the people that are there doing that particular service.
And if I can, and then Representative Samuels, let's talk about Open Arms daycare. It's not a state entity, but the problem is just the same. They got a hot roof running into a cold roof. The architect designed it that way. The builder built it right to the specifications of the architect, and it's a failed roof design. Who is that liability going to accrue to? If the contractor, can't, especially in a state contract, can't do anything more than build the design to the specifications of the architects and the engineers. So they build it that way, and then if the roof fails, then who does that liability accrue to? If it doesn't accrue at all to the designer who had a failed design, I've been reading these letters, and I have one, a support letter from a gentleman I know, Jack Wilbur, who's the president of Design Alaska, and he says, with your indulgence, that they strongly support House Bill 151. Prescribing indemnification language that is uniform for all governmental agencies in Alaska, which is what you're talking about vis-a-vis DOT and covering all entities, that requires each party to be financially responsible for their own negligent acts, errors, or admissions, which is also what you're talking about.
That's correct.
And that apportions liabilities on a comparative fault basis. That this will, as it's currently written, will clarify the contractual liabilities of the parties and allocate risk in a fair and balanced manner. But if the roof is leaking, like it is at Open Arms Daycare right now, and the contractor built it to the specifications of the designer, if it can be proven that the designer is at fault, we don't have any support letters or anything from AGC or from the Alaska builders or contractors, and I'm nervous when I see 20 letters from folks that obviously would want this, and nobody from the construction industry that is at least neutral on it.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I want to go back to the example that you cited.
Okay.
Very clearly, you said it yourself, if the design was bad and the construction was built to the design specification, then the designer's at fault.
But he doesn't accept any of the liability, and therein lies the problem.
No,
and that's precisely what the designer's doing, is say, hey, it's not my fault. I mean, that's exactly what's transpiring right now.
I respectfully, Mr. Chairman, must disagree. What we are trying to do is through this piece of legislation, eliminate that process where we can just say, no, it's not my fault, no, it's not my fault, no, it's not my fault, because they know that someone out there has been indemnified, that they've got to defend everyone down the line. The case you're talking about is going to end up in court. Two people are going to sue each other, and one of them is going to prevail. And that will be the winner. This has really very little to do with the scenario that you're painting. I could see a situation where a designer and a contractor, I designed it that way, I built it just like you said, they have to sue each other. But the engineer down the road who designed it is not in that battle. The way it would be, if there were an engineer involved in this, along with the designer, and he was indemnified, the two people who may in fact be responsible would not have a dog in the fight. The person further down the road who actually drew up the plans might have to defend both of them and not have any problem, even though, you know, the structural engineer did this and he indemnified everyone. He's defending it even though the designer designed it improperly. So I see your scenario as playing very well into what we're trying to do.
Thank you. If you design a building for DOT and you design the exact same building, the exact same contractor, everything is identical on the same land for the University of Alaska, and all roads lead back to the state treasury, liability is different now.
That's through the chair, Representative Samuels, yes.
Then that is a problem.
And that is the problem.
Okay. Are there other questions for the bill sponsor?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have a new version, an L version.
Yes.
Is that the version you want us to?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll make the motion to adopt it, if then somebody can object, so we can have that explained to us.
I was sorry. I was looking at the wrong version of that.
Therein lies the problem. No, sir. What we're talking about is not addressed in the CS.
But you do want us to take up the L?
I do want you to see it.
Then I'll move the L version if somebody would object.
I'll object so we can hear what the differences are, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you could. Thank you. Chair.
I was looking at the K version. Thanks for pointing out the errors. With your permission,
I apologize.
That was nicely done.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, humbly. The basic change is in the title, we added construction-related professionals. In the previous version, we had consultants, which opened it up to things like potentially having the ARM board and the permanent fund dividend board cost the state potentially millions of dollars, and I wasn't prepared to introduce a piece of legislation.
That was, Mr. Chair, that's in the K version. The title seems to be the same.
And I think what we did is we defined the construction. We went and defined what the construction.
Oh, so there's a new definition.
New definition.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Process of building in this section one.
If the members would look at page 2, line 26, it references a statute, and I just asked my staff to get me that statute because I'm not familiar with it. I'm trying to find it here. 36-39-90. Okay. This is definitions and professional services is defined. Do you want me to read that in the record?
Sure.
Okay. Professional services, that's in quotes, means professional, comma, technical, comma, or consultants, that's apostrophe S, services that are predominantly intellectual in character, result in the product of a report or the completion of a task, and include analysis, evaluation, prediction, planning, or recommendation. So, if I may, Mr. Chair, this does not appear to include contractors.
Through the chair, what this gets at is if once that intellectual property has been done, and the contractor's at fault, it doesn't fall back onto that definition. So it doesn't indemnify the contractor. It indemnifies, the only people that really have the indemnification problems are those definitions that you just, the designers, the creators of the intellectual property. They're the ones that have it in the contract that they will do the hold harmless and indemnify all the way down the line. The contractor has a little different set of circumstances.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So let's say we have an architect who designs, just for simplification, and a contractor, and then there's the state. How, if this bill passes, will the contractor be indemnified against architectural malpractice and vice versa?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't believe that the indemnification would carry over unless it was in the contract between the engineer and the contractor. What we're indemnifying against is the designer against the contractor's malfeasance or whatever, not following the plans, however it goes. And there may be some people online. We have some of the design engineers that probably would be much better at answering some of these more technical questions who have lived it more than I.
Because I think that your question is a question I'd have too. If we have an engineer and then a contractor in the state, we don't want the engineer to be off the hook for more than theirs, but have the whole thing fall back on the contractor or vice versa. We want it fairly apportioned over everybody. Wasn't that what you were getting at?
Yes. Yes.
Through the chair, and that is what we're getting at too. And if this language doesn't do it, that's why I'm sitting before this fine committee.
Oh.
Because this is, in fact, the committee that fixes that stuff.
Oh, Representative Johnson, it's so nice. Representative Holmes and Samuels, and we have about 5 minutes, and then we're going to move to Representative Lynn's bill. And we would like either you, because we're so stacked up here, just to contact AGC and the Alaskan Builders and Contractors.
36.
And if they have a, if they construe a neutral response to this, then I'm A-okay. It's just I'm nervous. On all my projects, the problems I've had have not been with the contractors. They've always, always been with the architects. Always. Oh, without exception. It's always been with the, and I know the TV's on, so with architects and engineers, but it's as in he's just a dumb plumber. What does he know? And then the next day, they're like, oh, man, we better stop the job and fix those bathrooms. We need handicapped bathrooms there. I mean, that's been ingrained in me for 15 years. And that really happened, and I've had experiences like that happen since then. And
Mr. Chairman, and I understand their questions, but if that is what the end result of this bill is, that everyone doesn't share mutually in their own errors and omissions, then this bill is not what I want to have happen.
Right.
I think from looking at it, it is.
I agree.
We'll have to flush it out. Okay. And once again, that's why I'm happy to be before you today.
So AGC and ABC, we can you'll weigh in with them.
Absolutely. And either private contractors as well as
bring it. Bring us into, I think that's a pretty well a catch all those two entities. I think Representative Samuels, did you have a question?
No, sir.
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
And then we'll go back to you, Representative Grunberg, and then we'll wrap it up for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on Representative Grunberg's point, I think the way he and I are understanding this right now with the use, and I'm looking at page one, lines 8 and 9, it appears that it only applies to construction-related professional services contracts. It looks like, as written right now, this language only would apply to the architects and the engineers and would not actually apply to the people who are building the building. Is it your intention that it also apply to the people who are building the building, or is it your intention that it only apply to the people who are designing and engineering the building?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, it's my understanding that the only people that have the indemnification contracts are the original designers, and if it carries over into the contractors, then we need to roll this into the bill as well. I will certainly look into that, and it will be part of my conversations with the contracting community to make sure that that happens. It is my intention, once again, for this bill to lay blame where blame is to be laid. If you're responsible, if you make the error, you're the one that needs to be. If it's shared, it should be shared responsibility. That's the intention. That's where we want to go, and hopefully that's where we'll get to.
Because there are most certainly indemnification clauses in the contracts with people who build the buildings. So if that's your intention, I think we need to
we'll certainly look into
look into that definition to broaden it a bit.
So Representative Johnson, as always, it's a pleasure to have you before this committee. You're esteemed, and we appreciate all the qualities that you bring before us.
You're too kind, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah,
thank you.
No. if you will help us, the two entities that would be representative of my concerns would be AGC and the ABC, the Alaska Builders and Contractors and the Alaska General Contractors. If they construe this as neutral and something that brings down the cost of architectural and engineering fees when you're trying to create some state work, would be fine. But I mean, I'm thinking about the University of Alaska Museum, for instance. I mean, what a nasty mess that is. But you know, is it the contractor, is it the university, or is it the all the A&E people that touch that? And so this bill may be, I can't read it right now, whether it helps to clarify that or whether it unfairly shifts the burden to one party or another. And I'm unclear on that element from this bill, and the support letters are so like 20-0 that I'm wondering who's looking out for the group that's zero, is kind of where I'm at. So if they say, hey, it's a pass and we're fine with this, then man, I'll let down that brick wall. But right now, that's the concern to me, is the contractors. Representative Grunberg.
And we had a question in the previous committee, and I think maybe Mr. Cohn was satisfied. I'm still a little bit questioned, and I'm kind of looking at Mr. Walsh in the background, too, that we'd like to have a visit with you folks on this other thing.
Sure.
Okay, so with that, we have a pending motion that's on the table, and we will set House Bill 151 aside.
Want to adopt the CS now?
Is there an objection?
There was an objection.
So the objection?
I objected. We can go ahead and adopt it. I'll remove my objection so we can have it before us next time around.
Okay, so we have the CS for 151-25-LS0479/L. is before us, and if we get this resolved, then I don't see any other issues with this, because the intent of it is good. We just want to make sure that we don't leave somebody unequally yoked.
I just have one question that we'll resolve, too.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you very much, Representative Justin. Nice to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, it's 245, Representative Lynn, House Bill 182, and I have the...
It's for version M. We need to go to version M.
Right. Got it, thank you.
I didn't know if you were making that.
I'm good, and it needs to be adopted, Representative Dolster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill number 182, version M.
M as in Mary. Without objection, we have House Bill 182, version M as in Mary, in front of us. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, this bill does not discuss designers or contractors, I'm happy to say. But this bill is, in fact, a small one-page bill with small checks that cause big headaches for Alaska's consumers. The checks we're talking about here are usually for no more than $3 or $4, which may be good for a cup of coffee or two at Starbucks. And these checks are sent to thousands of businesses and individuals throughout the state. And hundreds of our fellow Alaskans cash these little checks. The good news is these checks are legitimate. The bad news, the checks are legitimate. Because busy office workers and unsuspecting individuals endorse these little checks, seemingly with no strings attached, only to find themselves obligated for products and or services they don't want and, in fact, never needed. Last year, the Alaska Department of Law announced a settlement with a California-based company that sent Alaskans what appeared to be rebates from local Yellow Pages companies. But the dollars for one of these checks were $3.49. It was actually a contract for advertising services totaling $179, according to the company known as Yellow Pages Incorporated. Consumers who expected a very small windfall instead received a very much larger downfall. They missed the tiny fine print disclosure on the back of the check. They almost needed a magnifying glass to see it. Now, Alaska, along with 27 other states, eventually settled the Yellow Pages Incorporated and forced the company to make refunds to consumers, as well as to cover attorney fees and consumer protection enforcement costs. Unfortunately, there are many businesses that send these promotional checks. These checks go to individuals, they go to businesses and schools and churches and other organizations. And when cashed, the consumers end up getting billed, sometimes hounded by collection agencies. The Consumer Protection Unit of the Alaska Department of Law considers these promotional checks to be a classic example of an unfair or deceptive act of practice as defined in state law. As AS45.50.471 described it, it's conduct that, quote, creates a likelihood of confusion or of misunderstanding in which misleads, deceives, or damages a buyer or competitor with the sale or advertisement of goods or services, unquote. These checks certainly fit that definition, and this bill, HB 182, is a fitting answer to this misleading business practice. Our state attorneys believe that prohibiting the use of these checks is the only effective method of preventing these accidental agreements and subsequent charges from occurring. HB 182 makes the offering of these promotional checks through mail or other means an enumerated unfair or deceptive act of practice under state law. By making it an automatic violation of Alaska Consumer Protection Act, the Attorney General would then be able to take enforcement action under the Act to stop the use of these misleading checks. Companies that violate the law are then subject to a civil penalty of a minimum of $1,000 per violation and a maximum of $25,000 per violation. And I'm honored that the Alaska Department of Law approached me about drafting this legislation, and I agree with them that it's a very high priority. I also wanted to mention that after the first hearing and a quick passage of HB 182 in House Labor and Commerce Committee, all seven committee members not only wholeheartedly supported the bill, but they're anxious to fill out their green slips to sign its co-sponsors. I have some green slips right over there. And two of the witnesses expected to testify today will be able to speak for many of the Alaskans who have been harmed in the past, could be hurt in the future. And so Ed Sniffen is with the Department of Law to talk with us today about the particulars of this, and my staffer, Mike Seeker, is also in the audience who can go to the particulars of the bill.
Representative Lynn, as a humble co-sponsor of House Bill 182, it's difficult to imagine that someone could be more thorough in their presentation of a bill.
I try, because when I get to the end of the page, I'm done. I don't have to keep on going.
God bless you.
Thank you, my son.
Yeah. All right. Are there questions for the bill sponsor? I cannot imagine that there are, but are there questions for the bill sponsor?
Did we adopt the CS?
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we did. Okay.
Are there questions for the bill sponsor?
No.
You knocked us dead, Representative Lynn. With that, we have Mr. Sniffen on the line. Mr. Sniffen, are you with us?
Yes, Chairman Rammers, thank you.
Is there much more that you can add than that?
Through the chair, Ed Sniffen here with the Department of Law. No, there is not much more I can add to that, and I concur that that's a very thorough explanation of what this bill does. And we are very pleased that Representative Lynn has agreed to sponsor this legislation for us, and we think it's good legislation. We do have examples of consumers in Alaska who have been harmed by this practice. I'm happy to talk about those if you think it's necessary, but otherwise, I'm also happy to answer any questions the committee might have. And with that, thank you.
Yes, Representative Grover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a good bill to me. My questions are mainly technical ones. Is the word check broad enough on line 5?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think it is. I think everyone understands what a check is, what it means. We could say negotiable instrument, for example, or define it in a more legal way, but I think making it simple as it is, it gets the point across. I think it's broad enough for us. We for enforcement purposes, we'll know what a check is. And I think people who send them, they know what the check is. It's something different than, for example, a coupon that you could use to have a discount off of services if you wanted to contact the company to subscribe to services, as opposed to an instrument that you can actually take to the bank and negotiate. So I, Representative Gruenberg, I think it's sufficient.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
My only other question, they're all going to be the same line. I'm going to ask one generic question. Because you folks are up against some of the best consumer defense, consumer people on the defense bar. And I'm wondering if there's any word in this that is a weasel word that you want to tie down, because this is the committee to do it. Just, it's a short bill. Mr. Sniffen, is there anything you want us to close loophole-wise here?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I appreciate that opportunity, and our office actually drafted this language, and I think it's thorough enough and gives us all the enforcement that we need.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sniffen. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your help. Is there anybody here in the audience in their right mind that would like to testify on this subject matter? No, I see. As such, public testimony is closed. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to move the CS for House Bill number 182, version M, with zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, CS for House Bill 182, version M, is Mary passes from committee. It is 3:05. We are adjourned.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.